Green Mars, cassette 18.
So the weeks crept by. A campaign of regular street demonstrations began in Sheffield and South Fossa. Maya thought this would only bring more security down on them, but Art argued in their favor. We've got to let the transitional authority know how widespread the resistance is so that when the moment comes, they don't try to crush us out of ignorance. See what I mean? At this point, we need them to feel disliked and outnumbered. Hell, mass numbers of people in the streets are about the only thing that scare governments, if you ask me. And whether Maya agreed or not, there was nothing she could do about it. Every day passed, and she could only work as hard as possible, traveling and meeting group after group, while inside her body her muscles were turning to wire with the tension, and she could barely sleep at night, nothing more than an exhausted hour or two near dawn. One morning in the northern spring of M52, year 2127, she woke feeling more refreshed than usual. Michelle was still sleeping, and she dressed and went out alone and walked across the great central promenade to the cafes by the canal. This was the wonderful thing about Burrows. Despite tightened security at the gates and stations, one could still walk around freely inside the city at some hours, and among the throngs there was very little danger of being picked out. So she sat and drank coffee and ate pastries and looked at the low gray clouds rolling overhead, down the slope of Syrtis and toward the dike to the east. Air circulation under the tent was high to give some kinetic match to the visuals overhead. That was strange, that. How used she had gotten to the sky visuals not matching the feel of the wind under the tents. The long, slender arch tube of the bridge from Ellis Butte to Hunt Mesa was filled with the colorful ant figures of people hurrying about their morning's work. Living normal lives. Abruptly she got up and paid her bill and went for a long walk herself. She strolled along the rows of white Barice columns, up through Princess Park to the new tents, around the Pingo Hills where the currently fashionable apartments were located. Here in the high western district, one could look back down and see the whole spread of the city, the trees and rooftops split by the promenade and its canals, the mesas huge and widely spaced, resembling vast cathedrals. Their sheer rock sides were cracked and furrowed, horizontal lines of twinkling windows, the only clue that they were hollowed out inside, each of them a city of its own, a little world, living together on the red sand plain, under the immense invisible tent, connected by soaring footbridges that glinted like the visible sheen of soap bubbles. Ah, Burrows! So she walked back with the clouds through narrow streets walled by apartment blocks and gardens to Hunt Mesa and their home under the dance studio. Michelle and Spencer were out, and for a long time she just stood in the window and looked at the clouds racing over the city, trying to do Michelle's job for him, to lasso her moods and pull them back to some kind of stable center. From the ceiling came little uncoordinated thump-thump-thumps, another class beginning. Then the thumps were in the hall before the door, and there was a hard knock. She went to answer it, heart pounding like the ceiling. It was Jackie and Antar, and Art and Nirgal, and Rachel and France, and the rest of the zygote ectogenes, pouring in and talking at the speed of sound so that she couldn't quite understand them. She greeted them as cordially as she could, given Jackie's presence among them, and then collected herself and removed all hatred from her eyes and talked with all of them, even Jackie, about their plans. They had come to Burrows to help organize a demonstration down in the canal park. Word had been sent out through the cells, and they were hoping that a lot of the unaligned citizenry would join them as well. "I hope it doesn't precipitate any crackdowns," Maya said. Jackie smiled at her in triumph, of course. "Remember, you can never go back," she said. Maya rolled her eyes and went to put water on the stove, trying to quell her bitterness. They would meet with all the cell leaders in the city, and Jackie would take over the meeting and exhort them to immediate rebellion, no sense or strategy involved. and there was nothing Maya could do about it. The time for beating the shit out of her had passed, unfortunately. So she went around taking off people's coats and giving them bananas and kicking their feet off the couch cushions, feeling like a dinosaur among the mammals, a dinosaur in a new climate, among quick, hot creatures who disdained her galumphing around, who dodged her slow blows and ran end runs behind her dragging tail. Art came slouching out to help her with the teacups, scruffy and relaxed as always. She asked him what he'd heard from Fort, and he gave her the daily report from Earth. Subarashi and Consolidated were under attack by fundamentalist armies in what looked like a fundamentalist alliance, although that was an illusion, as the Christian and Muslim fundamentalists hated each other and despised the fundamentalist Hindus. The big Metanats had used the new UN to give warning that they would protect their interests with appropriate force. Praxis and Amex and Switzerland had urged use of the World Court, and India had done so, but no one else. Michelle said, "At least they're still afraid of the World Court." But to Maya it looked like the metanatricide was shifting to a war between the well-to-do and the mortals, which could be much more explosive. Total war rather than decapitations. She and Art talked the situation over as they served the people in the apartment tea. Spy or not, Art knew Terra and had an incisive political judgment which she found helpful. He was like a mellow Frank. Was that right? Somehow she was reminded of Frank, and though she couldn't pin down why, she was obscurely pleased. No one else could have seen any resemblance in this lumbering, sly man. It was her perception, and hers alone. Then more people began to crowd into the apartment, cell leaders and visitors from out of town. Maya sat at the back and listened as Jackie spoke to them. Everyone in the resistance, Maya thought, as she listened to her, was in it for themselves. The way Jackie used her grandfather as a symbol, waving him like a flag to rally her troops, was sickening. It wasn't John who had gotten her followers, but her white scoop blouse, the slut. No wonder Nergal was estranged from her. Now she exhorted them with her usual incendiary message, enthusiastically advocating immediate rebellion, no matter what the agreed-upon strategy was. And to these so-called Boonians, Maya was nothing more than an old paramour of the great man, or perhaps the reason he had been killed. A fossil odalisque, a historical embarrassment, an object of men's desire, like Helen of Troy called back by Faustus, insubstantial and weird. Ah! It was maddening. But she kept a calm face and got up and walked in and out of the kitchen with her head averted, doing what paramours did, keeping people comfortable and fed. Nothing more to be done at this point. She stood in the kitchen staring out the window at the rooftops below. She had lost whatever influence she had ever had on the resistance. The whole thing was going to come unraveled before Sax or any of the rest of them who counted were ready. Jackie was ranting on cheerily in the living room, organizing a demonstration that might get 10,000 people into the park, maybe 50, who could say? And if security responded with tear gas and rubber bullets and truncheons, people would get hurt, some killed. Killed for no strategic purpose, people who might have lived 1,000 years. And still Jackie went on, bright and enthusiastic, burning like a flame. Overhead the sun gleamed through a break in the clouds, bright silver, ominously large. Art came into the kitchen and sat at the table, switching on his AI and sticking his face into it. Got a note from home Praxis on the wrist. He read the screen, nose practically touching it.
"Are you nearsighted?"
Maya said irritably. "I don't think so."
"Oh, man! Kaboom!
Is Spencer out there? Get Spencer in here." Maya went to the doorway and signaled Spencer, who came in. Jackie ignored the disturbance and went on talking. Spencer sat down at the kitchen table beside Art, who was now sitting back, round-eyed and round-mouthed. Spencer read for 5 seconds and sat back in his chair, looked over at Maya with a strange expression.
"This is it," he said.
"What?"
"The trigger.
Maya went to him and stood reading over his shoulder. She held on to him, feeling a bizarre sensation of weightlessness. No more staving off the avalanche. She had done her job. She had just barely done it. At the very moment of failure, fate had turned. Nergal came into the kitchen to ask what was going on, attracted by something in their low voices. Art told him, and his eyes lit. He couldn't conceal his excitement. He turned to Maya and said, "It's true?" She could have kissed him for that. Instead, she nodded, not trusting herself to speak, and went to the doorway to the living room. Jackie was still in the midst of her exhortation, and it gave Maya the greatest of pleasure to interrupt her. "The demonstration's off!" "What do you mean?" Jackie said, startled and annoyed. "Why?" "Because we're having a revolution instead." Part 10. Phase Change. They were pelican surfing when apprentices jumping up and down on the beach alerted them that something was wrong. They flew back into the beach and stuck their landings on the wet sand and got the news. An hour later, they were up to the airport and soon after that taking off in a little skunkworks space plane called the Gollum. They headed south, and when they reached 50,000 feet, they were somewhere over Panama, and the pilot tilted it up and kicked in the rockets, and they were pressed back in their big G chairs for a few minutes. The three passengers were in cockpit seats behind the pilot and co-pilot, and out their windows they could see the exterior skin of the plane, which looked like pewter, begin to glow, and then quickly turn a vivid glowing yellow with a touch of bronze to it, brighter and brighter until it looked as if they were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego sitting together in the fiery furnace and coming to no harm. When the skin lost some of its glow and the pilot leveled them off, they were about 80 miles above the earth and looking down on the Amazon and the beautiful spinal curve of the Andes. As they flew south, one of the passengers, a geologist, told the other two more about the situation. "The West Antarctic ice sheet was resting on bedrock that's below sea level. It's continental land, though, not ocean bottom, and under West Antarctica, it's a kind of basin and range zone, very geothermally active." "West Antarctica?" Fort asked, squinting. "That's the smaller half, with the peninsula sticking up toward South America and the Ross Ice Shelf. The West Ice Sheet is between the mountains of the peninsula and the Transantarctic Mountains in the middle of the continent. Here, look, I brought a globe." He pulled from his pocket an inflatable globe, a child's toy, and blew it up and passed it around the cockpit. "So, the western ice sheet there was resting on bedrock below sea level. But the land down there is warm, and there are some under-ice volcanoes down there, and so the ice on the bottom gets melted a bit. This water mixes with sediments from the volcanoes and forms a substance called till. It has a consistency kind of like toothpaste. Where the ice is riding over this till, it moves faster than usual. So, within the west ice sheet, there were ice streams, like fast glaciers with their banks made of slower ice. Ice stream B ran 2 meters a day, for instance, while the ice around it moved 2 meters a year. And B was 50 kilometers across and a kilometer deep. So that was one hell of a river running off with about half a dozen other ice streams into the Ross Ice Shelf." He indicated these invisible streams with a fingertip. "Now, where the ice streams and the ice sheet in general came off the bedrock and started floating in the Ross Sea, that was called the grounding line." "Ah," said one of Fort's friends. "Global warming?" The geologist shook his head. "Our global warming has had very little effect on all this. It's raised temperatures and sea levels a little bit, but if that was all that was happening, it wouldn't make much difference here. The problem is we're still in the interglacial warming that began at the end of the last ice age, and that warming sends what we call a thermal pulse down through the polar ice sheets. That pulse has been moving down for 8,000 years, and the grounding line of the west ice sheet has been moving inland for 8,000 years. And now one of the under-ice volcanoes down there is erupting. A major eruption. About 3 months old now. The grounding line had already started to retreat at an accelerated rate some years ago, and it was very close to the volcano that's erupted. It looks like the eruption has brought the grounding line right to the volcano, and now ocean water is running between the ice sheet and the bedrock, right into an active eruption. And so the ice sheet is breaking up, lifting up, sliding out into the Ross Sea, and being carried away by currents. His listeners stared at the little inflatable globe. By this time, they were over Patagonia. The geologist answered their questions, pointing out features on the globe as he did. This kind of thing had happened before, he told them, and more than once. West Antarctica had been ocean, dry land, or ice sheet many times in the millions of years since tectonic movement had deposited that continent in that position. And there appeared to be several unstable points in the long-term temperature changes. Instability triggers, he called them, causing massive changes in a matter of years. This climatological stuff is practically instantaneous as far as geologists are concerned. Like, there's good evidence in the Greenland ice sheet that one time we went from glacial to interglacial in 3 years. The geologist shook his head. And these ice sheet breakups? Ford asked. Well, we think they might go typically in a couple hundred years, which is still very fast, mind you. A trigger event. But this time the volcano eruption makes it much worse. Hey, look, there's the banana belt. He pointed down, and across Drake Strait they saw a narrow, icy, mountainous peninsula pointing in the same direction as the coccyx of Tierra del Fuego. The pilot banked to the right, then more gently to the left, beginning a wide, lazy turn. Below them, as they stared down, was the familiar image of Antarctica as seen in satellite photos, but everything was now brilliantly colored and articulated. The cobalt blue of the ocean, the daisy chain of cyclonic cloud systems spinning away to the north, the textured sheen of the sun on the water, the great gleaming mass of the ice, and the flotillas of tiny icebergs, so white in the blue. But the familiar Q-shape of the continent was now strangely mottled in the area behind the comma of the Antarctic Peninsula, with gaping blue-black cracks in the white. And the Ross Sea was even more fractured by long ocean blue fjords and a radial pattern of turquoise blue cracks. And offshore from the Ross Sea, floating up toward the South Pacific, were some tabular icebergs that were like pieces of the continent itself sailing away. The biggest one looked to be about the same size as New Zealand's South Island, or even bigger. After they had pointed out the biggest tabular bergs to each other and the various features of the broken and reduced western ice sheet, the geologist indicated where he thought the volcano under the ice was, but it looked no different from the rest of the sheet, they simply sat in their seats and watched. "That's the Rona ice shelf there," the geologist said after a while. "And the Weddell Sea. Yeah, there's some slippage down into it, too. Up there's where McMurdo used to be, on the far side of the Ross ice shelf. Ice was pushed across the bay and ran up over the settlement." The pilot started a second lap around the continent. Fort said, "Now say again what effect this will have." "Well, theoretical models have world sea levels rising about 6 meters. 6 meters. Well, it will take a few years for the full rise, but it's definitely started. This catastrophic break will raise sea levels about 2 or 3 meters in a matter of weeks. What's left of the sheet will be afloat in a matter of months, or a few years at most, and that will add another 3 meters. How could it raise the whole ocean that much? It's a lot of ice. It can't be that much ice. Yes, it can. That's most of the fresh water in the world right down there under us. Just be thankful the East Antarctic ice sheet is nice and stable. If it were to slide off, sea levels would rise 60 meters.
6 meters is plenty, Fort said.
They finished another lap. The pilot said, "We should be getting back."
"That's it for every beach in the world," Fort said, pulling his face back from the window. Then, "I guess we'd better go get our stuff."
When the second Martian Revolution began, Nadia was in the upper canyon of Shalbatana Vallis, north of Marineris. In a sense, one could say that she started it. She had left South Fossa temporarily to oversee the Shalbatana closure, which was similar to those over Nergal Vallis and the East Hellas Valleys. A long tent roof over a temperate ecology with a stream running down the canyon floor, in this case supplied by pumping from the Lewis Aquifer, 170 kilometers to the south. Shalbatana was a long series of lazy S's so that the valley floor looked very picturesque, but the construction of the roof had been complicated. Nevertheless, Nadia had directed the project with only one small part of her attention, the rest being focused on the cascading developments on Earth. She was in daily communication with her group in South Fossa and with Art and Nergal in Burrows, and they kept her informed of all the latest news. She was particularly interested in the activities of the World Court, which was trying to establish itself as an arbitrator in the growing conflict of the Subarashi Metanats and the Group of 11 against Praxis, Switzerland, and the developing China-India alliance, trying to function, as Art had put it, as a sort of world court. That effort had looked doomed when the fundamentalist riots began and the Metanats prepared to defend themselves, and Nadia had concluded unhappily that things on Earth were about to spiral down into chaos again. But all these crises were immediately cast into insignificance when Sax called to tell her of the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet. She had taken his call at her desk in one of the construction trailers, and now she stared at his little face on the screen. "What do you mean, collapsed?" "It's lifted off the bedrock. There's a volcano erupting. It's being broken up by ocean currents." The video image he was sending cut to Punta Arena, a Chilean harbor town with its docks gone and its streets awash. Then it cut again to Port Elizabeth in Azania, where the situation was much the same. "How fast is it?" Nadia said. "Is it a tidal wave?" "No. More like a very high tide that will never go away." "So enough time to evacuate," Nadia said, "but not enough time to build anything. And you say 6 meters? "But only over the next few... No one is sure how long. I've seen estimates that as much as a quarter of the Terran population will be affected." "I believe it." "Oh, Sax." A worldwide stampede to higher ground. Nadia stared at the screen, feeling stunned as the scale of the catastrophe became clearer to her. Coastal cities would be awash, 6 meters. She found it very hard to imagine that any possible ice mass could be so large as to raise the sea level of all Earth's oceans by even as much as 1 meter, but 6. It was shocking proof, if one needed it, that the Earth was not so big after all. Or else that the West Antarctic ice sheet was huge. Well, it had covered about a third of a continent and was, the report said, some 3 kilometers thick. That was a lot of ice. Sax was saying something about the East Antarctic ice sheet, which apparently was not threatened. She shook her head to clear it of this nattering, concentrated on the news. Bangladesh would have to be entirely evacuated. That was 300 million people. Not to mention the other coastal cities of India, like Calcutta, Madras, Bombay. Then London, Copenhagen, Istanbul, Amsterdam, New York, Los Angeles, New Orleans, Miami, Rio, Buenos Aires, Sydney, Melbourne, Singapore, Hong Kong, Manila, Jakarta, Tokyo. And those were only the big ones. A lot of people lived on the coast, in a world already severely stressed by overpopulation and declining resources, and now all kinds of basic necessities were being drowned by salt water. "Sax," she said, "we should be helping them, not just..." "There is not that much we can do, and we can do that best if we're free. First one, then the other." "You promise?" "Yes," he said, looking surprised. "I mean, I'll do what I can."
That's what I'm asking. She thought it over. You've got everything ready at your end?
Yes. We want to start with missile strikes against all surveillance and weapons satellites.
What about Cassae Vallis?
I'm dealing with it.
When do you want to start?
How about tomorrow?
Tomorrow?
I have to deal with Cassae very soon. Conditions are good right now.
What are you going to do?
Let's try to launch tomorrow. No sense wasting time.
My God,
Nadia said, thinking hard.
We're about to go behind the sun?
Yes. This position vis-à-vis Earth was mostly a symbolic matter these days, as communications were assured by a great number of asteroid relays. But it did mean that it would take months for even the fastest shuttles to get from Earth to Mars. Nadia took a deep breath, let it out. She said, "Let's go, then."
"I was hoping you would say that. I'll call them in Burrows and give them the word."
"We'll meet in Underhill?"
This was their current rendezvous point in case of emergency. Sax was in a refuge in Da Vinci Crater where a lot of his missile silos were located, so both of them could get to Underhill in a day.
"Yes," he said. "Tomorrow."
And he was gone. And so she had started a revolution. She found a news program running the satellite photo of Antarctic and watched it in a kind of daze. Little voices on the screen chattered at speed, one claiming that the disaster was an act of écotage perpetrated by écoteurs from Praxis, who supposedly had drilled holes in the ice sheet and set hydrogen bombs down on the Antarctic bedrock.
"Still at it," she cried, disgusted.
No other news shows made this assertion or refuted it. It was just part of the chaos, no doubt, swept away by all the other accounts of the flood. But the Metanatra side was still on, and they were part of it. All existence immediately reduced itself to that, in a way sharply reminiscent of 61. She felt her stomach nodding as of old, tightening past any usual levels of tension into an iron walnut at the center of her being, painful and constricting. She had been taking medicine recently to prevent ulcers, but it was woefully inadequate against this kind of assault. "Come on," she told herself. "Be calm. This is the moment. You've expected it. You've worked on it. You've laid the groundwork for it." Now came the chaos. At the heart of any phase change, there was a zone of cascading, recombinant chaos, but there were methods to read it, to deal with it. She crossed the little mobile habitat and glanced briefly down at the idyllic beauty of the canyon floor of Shalbatana, with its pebble-pink stream and the new trees, including strings of cottonwood on the banks and islands. It was possible, if things went drastically wrong, that no one would ever inhabit Shalbatana Vallis, that it would remain an empty bubble world until mudstorms caved the roof in, or something in the mesocosmic ecology went awry. Well? She shrugged and woke her crew and told them to get ready to leave for Underhill. She told them why, and as they were all part of the resistance in one way or another, they cheered. It was just after dawn on what was looking to be a warm spring day, the kind that had allowed them to work in loose walkers and hoods and face masks, with only the insulated hard boots to remind Nadia of the bulky clothing of the early years. Friday, LS-101, 2 July 2, M-Year 52. Terran date, she'd checked her wrist pad, October 12th, 2127. Somewhere near the 100th anniversary of their arrival, though it was a date no one seemed to be celebrating. 100 years. It was a bizarre thought. Another July Revolution then, and another October Revolution too. A decade past the bicentennial of the Bolshevik Revolution, she seemed to remember, which was another strange thought. Well, but they too had tried. All the revolutionaries, all through history.
mostly desperate peasants fighting for their children's lives, as in her Russia. So many in that bitter 20th century, risking all to make a better life, and even so it had led to disaster. It was frightening, as if history were a series of human wave assaults on misery, failing time after time. But the Russian in her, the cerebellum Siberian, decided to take the October date as a good auspice, or a reminder of what not to do, if nothing else, along with 61. She could, in her Siberian mind, dedicate this time to all of them, to the heroic suffering of the Soviet catastrophe, to all her friends dead in 61, to Arkady and Alex and Sasha and Roald and Janet and Evgenia and Samantha, all of whom still haunted her dreams and her attenuated insomniac memories, spinning like electrons around the iron walnut inside her, warning her not to screw it up, to get it right this time, to redeem the meanings of their lives and their deaths. She remembered someone saying to her, "Next time you have a revolution, you'd better try some other way." And now they were. But there were Mars First guerrilla units under Casey's command, out of contact with the headquarters in Burrows, as well as 1,000 other factors coming to bear, most of them completely out of her control, cascading recombinant chaos. So how different was it going to be? She got her crew into rovers and over to the little Piest station, some kilometers to the north of them. From there they rode in a freight train on a mobile Piest laid for the Shalbatana job, on to the main Sheffield Burrows line. Both those cities were Medinat strongholds, and Nadia worried that they would take pains to secure the Piest linking them. In that sense, Underhill was strategically important, as occupying it would cut the Piest. But for that very reason she wanted to get away from Underhill and off the Piest system entirely. She wanted to get into the air, as she had in 61. All the instincts learned in those few months were trying to take over again, as if 66 years hadn't passed, and those instincts told her to hide. As they glided southwest over the desert, shooting the gap between Ophir and Juventi chasmas, she kept her wrist pad linked to Sax's headquarters in Da Vinci Crater. Sax's team of technicians were trying to imitate his dry style, but it was obvious that they were just as excited as her young construction crew. About 5 of them got on the wrist at once to tell her that they had set off a barrage of the surface-to-space missiles which Sax had arranged to have placed in hidden equatorial silos over the past decade, and this barrage had gone off like a fireworks display and had knocked out all of the orbiting Medinat weapons platforms that they knew of, and many of their communications satellites as well. "We got 80% of them in the first wave! We sent up our own communication satellites. Now we're dealing with them on a case-by-case basis," Nadia interrupted. "Are your satellites working?" "We think they're fine. We can only tell for sure after a full test, and everyone's kind of busy right now. Let's try one out now, and some of you make that a priority, you understand? We need a redundant system, a very redundant system." She clicked off and tapped out one of the frequency and encryption codes Sax had given her. A few seconds later, she was talking to Zake, who was in Odessa, helping to coordinate activities in the Hellas Basin. "Everything there was going according to plan so far," he said. Of course, they were only a few hours into it, but it looked like Michelle and Maya's organizing there had paid off, because all the cell members in Odessa had poured into the streets and told people what was happening, sparking a spontaneous mass work stoppage and demonstration. They were in the process of closing down the train station and occupying the Cornish and most other public spaces in a strike that looked like it would soon be a takeover. The transitional authority personnel in the city were retreating to the train station or the physical plant, as Zake had hoped they would. "When most of them are inside, we're going to override the plant's AI, and then it'll become a jail holding them. We've got control of the backup life support systems for the town, so there's very little they can do except maybe blow themselves up, but we don't think they'll do that. A lot of the UNTA people here are Syrians under Niazi. And I'm talking to Rashid while we try to disable the physical plant from the outside, just to make sure no one in there can decide to become a martyr.
I don't think there will be too many martyrs to the Metanationals, Nadia said.
I hope not, but you never can tell. So far, so good here, though. And elsewhere around Hellas, it's been even easier. The security forces were minimal, and most of the population are natives or radicalized emigrants, and they've simply been surrounding security and daring them to do anything violent. It has resulted either in a standoff, or else in the security forces being disarmed. Dao and Harmachis Rule have both declared themselves free canyons, and invited anyone who wants to take refuge there if they need it.
Good. Zake heard the surprise in her voice and warned,
I don't think it will be as easy in Burrows and Sheffield, and we need to shut down the elevator so they don't start shooting at us from Clark.
At least Clark is stuck over Tharsis.
True, but it sure would be nice to seize that thing and not have the elevator come crashing down again.
I know. I heard the Reds have been working with Sachs on a plan for seizure.
Allah preserve us. I must be off, Nadia. Tell Sachs that the programs for the plant worked perfectly. And listen, we should come up and join you in the north, I think. If we can secure Hellas and Elysium quickly, it will help our chances with Burrows and Sheffield.
So Hellas was going as planned. And just as important, or more, they were still in communication with each other. This was critical. Among all the nightmare images of 61, scenes illuminated in her memory by lightning bolts of fear or pain, few were worse than the feeling of sheer helplessness that had struck her when their communication system had crashed. After that, nothing they did had mattered. They had been like insects with their antennae ripped off, stumbling around ineffectually. So in the last few years, Nadia had repeatedly insisted to Sachs that he come up with a plan for hardening their communications. And he had built, and now put in orbit, a whole fleet of very small communications satellites, stealthed and hardened as much as possible. So far, they were functioning as planned. And the iron walnut within her, while not gone, was at least not pulling in so hard at her ribs.
Calm, she told herself. Thisness. This is the moment, and the only moment. Concentrate on it.
This ends side one of cassette 18. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.